This is Christopher Golden, and you're listening to Spoiler Country.
Hey, hey, people of Earth, it's time to enter the Spoilerverse via our secret portal at the exclusive Arctic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle with our hosts, John and Kenrick. Welcome to Spoiler Country.
Hey, if you're listening to our show for the first time and you're on one of the social medias that we're on, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things, you should always check us out on Spoilerverse.com. But if you want to keep up with our latest episodes, you should bring out your smartphone, get into your favorite podcatcher, find Spoiler Country, and hit subscribe. Then you'll get all our new stuff.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that in two ways. You can call us, leave us a voicemail at 707-656-2080. Again, 707-656-2080. Or you can shoot us an email at spoilercountry@gmail.com.
United Armies of the Spoilerverse, welcome back to Spoiler Country. I'm Kenneth Regan. That's Mr. Horsley. And today on the show, well, it's Christopher Golden, isn't it?
It is. He was a fun dude to talk to, man.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. I really, really liked having that chat with him. I want to talk to him again.
Yeah, he was a lot of fun. He was a lot of fun.
Yeah, he co-wrote some books with what's her name?
Amber Benson from Buffy.
Tara. Right. Amber Benson from Buffy.
That goes to the Albion series. Yeah.
Yep, which you can actually find online. They did some cartoon work with it.
Yeah, the BBC has some, I guess they're old now because it's Flash animation, but
yeah,
you know, it's
which
there.
Is weird. You thought Flash was going to be like the next big thing, and then it was a Flash.
Flash was a big thing for a while until it became super exploitable and people started getting viruses through it.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah. It's
they just have no way to locking it down?
Yeah, there's so many exploits in Flash, and they keep updating it, but
But no one uses it now. Now a lot of the
obviously block it.
Well, a lot of the browsers don't even support it anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I don't think Chrome or Firefox supports it.
Yeah, not the way like they'd have to do it to do actual Flash like animation stuff. But
yeah. Anyways,
he also worked with Mike Mignola on Hellboy and Joe Golem and yep. Lady Baltimore yep. coming out
Joe
soon,
Golem which is so good.
Yeah, and he's got a for lack of a better term a yeah. shit ton of novels.
Yeah, dude is very prolific.
Yeah.
But let's get into it because Christopher is a great guy to listen to and he's a lot of fun. And if you listen to if you are on Twitter, he tweets all the time and he's not scared to talk about his political views.
It's a lot of fun.
So let's get into it. Let's listen to Christopher Golden in his own words. All right, guys, welcome back, and we're excited today because we have a special guest. You know him from novels such as The Ferryman, Joe Golem in The Drowning City, Snowblind, Indigo with Charlene Harris, Hellboy,
you did,
The Last Army, and Baltimore or The Steadfast Tin Soldier and The Vampire with Mike Mignola. Christopher Golden, thank you so much for coming on, man.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I think Hellboy was the, 2000s porn version. Right?
Yeah, it might have been. Lots of explosions.
The good version. Oh, wait. just kidding.
Hey.
It's Michael Bay's version of Hellboy. Oh, that's hilarious. Chris, thanks for coming on, man. This is awesome.
It's my pleasure, man. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, you are a hardworking man. You look you up on Wikipedia or all the stuff that you have. You, for lack of a better word, you are super prolific.
You know what, dude? I have been writing full-time since 1992. I quit my job in 1992, and if you look me up and I look super prolific, it's called making a living.
I love it.
And it is true. I am super prolific, but it definitely is about making a living. It's also about having interests that take me into a bunch of different mediums and a bunch of different genres.
Yeah. Yeah. You're primarily known for horror or supernatural stuff.
Yes.
But what kind of other...
That's where my heart is.
Yeah. Well, it kind of helps growing up in Farmingham, right? So yeah, how much did that really help you with the horror
Framingham,
stuff? Framingham. Did I say Farmingham?
Yeah, yeah. Framingham, you know, Framingham actually was a great place to grow up, but it was the breeding ground for a million suburban horror stories.
Yeah. So, like, Michael Myers?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, the first time I saw Halloween, I looked at it and I was like, that might say Haddonfield, Illinois, but it looks a hell of a lot like the street, like, around the corner from me.
We grew up in a small town called Bremerton, Washington, and it's a lot of the same things when you saw the small suburban horror stories, like A Nightmare on Elm Street. Yeah. It was like, oh, there's an Elm Street right down the street from my house. That's great.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah. You're a big horror fan, obviously a big Halloween fan. You told a great story of Halloween and the fake hand, and I'm hoping that maybe I can convince you to repeat it.
Yeah, it's funny. Well, you talk about Framingham. My mom still lives in Framingham, and my mom was born with, I can't remember the name of the condition, but you'll have seen it with, there are some professional baseball players. There's a baseball pitcher. I've seen it a couple times with her left hand. She was born with not much of a left hand.
Yeah.
And so she was a performer on stage in college. She went to Marymount College in Tarrytown, New York, and she performed off-Broadway in the city. And so her parents had gotten her made this sort of rubber or plastic prosthetic that would go over her hand so that when she performed, it wasn't something that would draw the attention of the audience.
Right.
And as a little kid, I found this thing. I mean, she hadn't used it in years and years, obviously. And I found this thing, and I was like, this is cool. By the way, can I swear on your show?
You can fucking swear as much as you want.
It's unnatural. I catch myself not swearing.
I don't trust people who don't swear, so, you know.
Yeah, so anyway, the hand was so fucking cool. And so what I did this one Halloween is I had a Frankenstein's monster mask, and I was probably, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old, I don't remember. And I put on a big coat, and I went out door to door to trick or treat. And every time I went to a door, I would go to shake hands with the person who would answer the door. And when they would grab the hand that I extended, I would yank my arm back and scream when they were holding the prosthetic hand in their hand. And I think I almost killed Mrs. Nye, who was the woman who lived like two doors down from me. Scared That's awesome. The living shit out of her. You're
such a little fucker, man.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it gave me such pleasure. You know, like I really liked it. I liked the fact that I scared the shit out of her. But in a pure way. I wouldn't have, like, you know, gone outside her window and banged on it and, like, flashed a knife and then run away cackling.
Right.
There may have been kids in my neighborhood who would do that, but it wasn't going to be me. But it was Halloween. That was the whole spirit of it. That was what it was all about, you know?
I love that story. I heard you tell it, but I knew there was more to it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, just, you know.
That's awesome.
That I so want to get a hand just to do that, you know? Because I just, oh my God. So, Kolchak the Night Stalker, I myself, as are you, a huge fan of the show, and it's kind of shocking to find how many people just don't know about it
and how much it's influenced. Well, it's not shocking, though, really. I mean, I think that you have to have lived in a very narrow window of time and been a certain age during that narrow window to have seen the show, because then it came on later in reruns, but it wasn't something that was popped up a lot.
Right.
Until X number of years ago, for a while it was on Netflix. So I actually have this Kolchak the Night Stalker t-shirt, and I was in my local supermarket one day.
Yeah.
And this girl who was probably 17 or 18 years old saw my shirt, and she was like, oh my God, great t-shirt. I love that show.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I looked at her like she had six heads. I was like, how do you know this show?
Yeah.
And she's like, well, I watched all of the X-Files on Netflix, and then when I finished it, it suggested that to watch next. And so I watched it and I loved it. And that just made me so happy. But unfortunately it's not on Netflix right now. But yeah, that was the show. Look, you know, that there are certain components, and I'm actually toying with the beginnings of a sort of career memoir. There'll be like six people who want to read it, but that's fine. I mean, it's mostly for me. But and one of the things I'm talking about in the section I'm working on now is just the few things that are really the sort of, you know, central elements to the beginnings of me, you know, being passionate about this stuff and Kolchak. So my dad, my parents split up when I was like 11, but Kolchak was on, I want to say it was like in, well, whatever year it was, the following year.
Yeah.
It only ran for one season.
That's right.
20 episodes. And the following year, they ran it at 11 o'clock at night from beginning to end. The whole, like, you know, every night at 11. So,
that's cool.
I had seen an ad for it. And I convinced my dad to wake me up. So I'd go to bed at like 9, however old I was. And then he'd wake me up to watch Kolchak at 11 o'clock. And
what?
Then I'd go back to sleep at midnight.
That's a dad that's seeing the passion in his son's eyes. Says, all right, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, you know,
this.
The thing is, like, I think there are a lot of things that my dad fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like a really good thing that he did for me.
Right. It's a nice memory.
Yeah, it was a really, like, it was a thing where he definitely saw, like, this is a thing that's important to this kid, and why not?
Yeah.
Because he was going to be awake, so, did so
he
why
watch
not?
Him with
so
you?
He would wake me up, and I'd watch Kolchak and go back to sleep. So Kolchak and Marvel Comics' Tomb of Dracula comic book
nice.
Series were two of the big sort of foundational elements.
Dude, the Tomb of Dracula is a great book. I'm kind of – I wish they would bring that particular style back, you know, and have it it's hard to put a point on it. Like I have like 1 through 9. I don't have number 10 because it's just I just can't afford it, you know. I just can't bring myself to spend the money on it. And then
well,
I
listen
have,
you know, they're collecting it now in I mean there are the omnibuses,
but yeah
it, yeah, in the complete full color, you know. And that's a book that, you know, if you said to me, okay, you can only ever do one Marvel comic forever from now on.
That'd be the one.
And you get to pick which one, anything you want, it would be that.
Did you see the animated version of that? That Japanese?
I have the Japanese one.
Yeah, it played.
Yeah.
So we're close enough to Canada that in the 80s, you would get KVOS, which was a local station out of Vancouver. And it was Channel 12.
Okay.
And they played that on Halloween back in like 1984, 85. And I remember sitting, my mom, so my mom's super religious. So I'm 12. No, I'm 10. 84, I'm 10. So I was 10 or 11. I'm sitting in my mom's room because her and my dad had a TV in there. And I could go in there and watch TV and no one would be there, you know? So I could kind of get away with watching what I want. And I remember I was like, that was on. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I'm watching it. And every time my mother came into the room, like switching it to Channel 11, watching, like, it was like Taxi rerun, you know? And then she'd leave, switch it back. Okay. I didn't miss anything. And it was crazy. And then it took me forever to find that. And it wasn't until I was a manager at a video store in the mid 90s that I was able to just order that movie, you know, and have it come in, and no one else even knew what the heck it was. And I was like, oh, I got to get this because I remember watching it.
I didn't know about it for years. But what's really cool about it is that it's really faithful.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not necessarily the same story, but the whole look and feel of it.
Yeah.
Is super faithful to the original comic.
So how much is Kolchak? Is there a lot of Kolchak in Joe Golem? Was there a lot of influence there?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, look, so I would say if you go back to my very first novel, which is called Of Saints and Shadows, and led into, there's 7 books in that series. But the first one is hugely influenced by both Kolchak and the character Hannibal King from Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah.
With Joe Golem, I think there are so many elements in that stew. I mean, so I guess we have to say, start with the conversation about working with Mike, because, you know, one of the reasons that Mignola and I have always gotten on well together and always worked well together is even though our frames of reference are very different.
Yeah.
There is a lot of overlap, and our interests in folklore and all of that stuff really heavily overlap. And so Joe Golem and the Drowning City was Mike's idea. But when it came to write it, I did tap into a lot of the tonal stuff with not necessarily Kolchak. I mean, I can kind of see that.
Yeah.
But for me, it's like 1930s and 40s Hollywood movies is where you get the Joe character from.
Right.
You know, and there's a reason he has the hat and the coat, and it looks like, you know, if Humphrey Bogart were a much bigger dude and got punched in the face a bunch of times, is kind of what Joe looks like.
Right.
Yeah, he looks like a boxer who lost one too many fights, you know.
I love that analogy. That's hilarious.
And I think tonally, that does, there is some Kolchak in that too. You know, yeah. They're all, you know, they swim in the same stream.
Yeah. This makes me want to go and do a Kolchak marathon. It's been a long time.
Yeah, I actually realized the other day.
I've actually never seen Kolchak.
My middle child, my son Dan, is 24 and he's a graduate student. And he's quarantined, well, isolated here with us at home. And he's teaching and taking classes from home for his graduate degree.
Oh,
and
nice.
He loves horror movies. And I realized the other day we were talking, he's never seen Kolchak.
Oh yeah, Johnny just said he's never seen it. Yeah, you gotta have to fix that.
Yeah, I plan to. I've heard of it, but I never actually seen it before. So now I want to watch it.
It's just the whistling theme song alone, and the melodramatic performance of Darren McGavin. You know, I have only a few signed things in my office, but. One of them is a signed picture of Darren McGavin as Kolchak.
So. Oh, that's cool. I found that not when I was a kid, but when I was a tester for Microsoft, and I worked.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I worked on doing what was on Vista with Xbox 360, and it was streaming media from your Vista machine to your Xbox 360. Right, that was the component that I worked on, and. One of the scenes that we used was a Kolchak scene.
Oh, that's great.
And it was like the intro, it was like him typing on his typewriter. And then I was like, what is this? You know what I mean? I didn't know what it was. I was like, what is this guy?
And then you discovered it was the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, right. Well, this guy came in and he goes, oh, that's Kolchak the Night Stalker. And he was quite a bit older than me. He was like in his 60s. Early 60s. He's like, it was on in the 70s and it was only on for a season. It was fun. You should check it out. Or you should try to find it. And then it made it my mission to try to find it online. And
so if anyone wants to know, you can watch all 20 episodes on NBC.com. They're all up there.
Oh, that's great.
Well, there you go. NBC.com.
If you're going to do that, you have to first watch the two full length TV movies. They were written by Richard Matheson.
Oh. I love Matheson.
So the first TV movie is called The Night Stalker.
It's called what?
And the second TV movie is called The Night Strangler. And then the 20 episodes of Kolchak.
There you go. I don't know if I've seen those movies.
I was a kid. I mean, I was born in 67. So I'll be 53 this year.
Yeah.
And so whenever Kolchak came on, I can't remember what year it was, but I was a kid. I was little, you know. But it was the greatest thing ever.
Oh my God. You know what? I don't think I've ever saw those movies. I only ever saw the TV show.
Yeah. And the second movie, by the way, takes place in Seattle.
Oh my God. I'm so going to go watch those now. I got to find them.
Yeah. It's all about the buried Seattle.
The underground city.
Yeah.
Which isn't really all that much. Have you ever been to Seattle?
In the Night Strangler, it is.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah. Do you come to Seattle often or ever? Or like for some of the cons?
I've never been.
What's that?
I've never been there. I've always wanted to.
Oh, you should come for Emerald City when they finally have it going. The Emerald City Comic Con.
Yeah, well, you know, someday maybe they'll invite me. We'll see.
Oh, my God. We got to send this to them and say, what are you guys doing? Just look at all the stuff. Look at all these people. What was it like working with Joe Hill?
Well, I've never worked with Joe.
You just did the forward.
I wrote the introduction to his first collection of short stories for his first book, actually, 20th Century Ghosts.
Yeah.
And at the time, in fact, I just literally just wrote the introduction to a new, like, super limited edition of that book 15 years later. And so I wrote a new introduction to my introduction that's basically all about how when I first met Joe. I didn't know that he was Stephen King's son.
Yeah.
So we became friends and went to the movies and hung out and went to dinner and did all kinds of stuff without me realizing that. And I wrote the introduction to this book and I had a barbecue, sort of big, a bunch of writers and artists and editors and friends came over.
Yeah.
And Joe was here, and my friend Rick Howdala, who's since passed away, unfortunately, came up to me, and he's from Maine. He was a horror writer from Maine. He used to be referred to often as the other horror writer from Maine. And he went to college with Stephen King.
Oh, wow.
And he was here, and he knew Stephen College. And after Joe left, Rick came up to me, and he was like, "Come on, man, that's Joe King." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "I'm telling you." And that was the Joe beginning. Yeah, exactly. And I felt like such an idiot afterwards.
You know, he probably appreciated it, though.
Well, you know, he really did. Look, this is a guy, you'll have to read my introduction, but
I want to.
The whole point of the introduction is basically me saying how important it was for him to begin his career in a space where it didn't matter that he was Stephen King's son.
Yeah.
Because then once all the people started to come in and they were just like, "Oh, you know, he got this contract and all this attention and all this marketing and blah, 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 because he's Stephen King's son." And for a period, there were always those trolls who would come out and say shit like that. But
yeah,
now we've gotten to the point where it once again, it no longer matters. So it didn't matter at first, and it doesn't matter now.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important journey that he's taken, so that, you know, sure, there's still going to be some people who talk shit, but
sure,
he has more than proven that he has his key. Talents are his own. You know yeah. what I mean?
Lock and Key is phenomenal. I didn't know he was Stephen King's son. I saw Joe Hill. I read Lock and Key. I'm like, this is great. You know?
Yeah.
No clue until I think Johnny told me. He's like, "Oh, that's Stephen King's son." I'm like, "What?"
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing is that Joe considers himself, I think, in some ways, a comic book writer first.
That's cool.
Yeah, which I think is I think is good. You know, he loves the form as I do. But yeah, so no, he's, you know, I would say the one thing that everybody should worry about with Joe is that he's a little bit too obsessed with the movie Jaws. So just be careful. if you run into him, don't say anything negative about Jaws, because he might cut.
Well, I would love to have a conversation with him, because his work is, you know, he does some phenomenal stuff, and it's cool to see the journey, how he got there. Hey, yeah. You have a similar view that I have, and I think Johnny has the same one, is that you're not really into gratuitous violence for violence sake. And
yeah, I mean, it has its place.
Yeah, and that's what that was my question was going to be. Is there a place for it? And if so, you know, where and when?
Look, I think it just depends on the tone that you're going for.
Yeah.
You know, look, RoboCop, to go back a minute.
Yeah, I love that movie.
You know, that's RoboCop so has a lot of really disgusting violence,
mm-hmm.
but it's there for a reason. I mean, it's
meant to be over the top.
It's purposeful, you know, and when you're reacting to it, the reaction that you're having is a reaction that Paul Verhoeven wanted you to have.
That visceral reaction.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, you know, when the guy's head explodes like a fucking watermelon on the hood of a car or whatever it was, you know, he intends he wants to shock you, but he's doing it in a way that is, I hate it, it's a weird thing because it's everyone to their tastes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But a friend of mine who shall remain nameless, I used to go to these, when I was younger, I would go to these writers' conventions. I still do. But in the days of VHS,
yep.
Several writers, including John Skip and a bunch of other people, you'd go to a convention and they'd be like, "Dude, I just got a bootleg of this thing that nobody's seen except blah, blah, blah. And you've got to come upstairs to the room and watch it." So it'd be 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and there'd be 20 people huddled in a hotel room watching this bootleg of whatever. And, you know, whether it be like Urotsuka Doji, Legend of the Overfiend, or, you know, like whatever it might be. And one time it was Guinea Pig.
Oh.
And I don't know if you've ever seen Guinea Pig.
No.
Don't.
Thank you.
It's, you know, there's a scene in Guinea Pig where this person is being tortured, and they the guy takes a grapefruit spoon which has serrated on the end, and digs out this guy's eyeball with it. And the thing is, this movie exists for no reason other than to push that envelope.
Like Faces of Death?
Oh, yeah, I never would watch that shit.
Yeah.
Because Faces of Death, yeah, I would never watch that stuff. Because I just thought, I just think it's putrid.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Faces of Death, is all it is one death scene after another. And apparently some are real, but most of it is fake. And it was just, I remember my buddy got it, and we started watching it, and I was like, I don't want to sit through this. This is a snuff film.
Right. Right, yeah, and that's gross. The thing to me. It's like, it's that if that's the only reason that you're entertained, that's a problem.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
you got issues.
So I just think, but I think that there's, you know, there's a limit. And listen, I love a good gory movie, depending on the movie. You know, you go back to the original Dawn of the Dead and the scene where the guy's wife or the woman's husband, like she thinks she's got him back and she's hugging him and he takes a gigantic, bloody, disgusting bite out of her shoulder.
Yeah.
It's shocking for more reasons than just the gore.
Right.
You know, so I'm not saying I don't like gory movies. I do, depending on what it's there.
Hey,
and then as far as violence is concerned, you know, like, again, I've got nothing against violence in movies. But depending on what it is, when I was in college, I interviewed Clive Barker.
Yeah. Ooh, what was that like?
Oh, cool.
And no, I know Clive. He's an amazing guy. Always has been incredibly supportive. It's including when I was super young.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I met him for the first time when I was probably 20 or 21. And I was interviewing him. He had just screened Hellraiser. He was screening Hellraiser at colleges around the country. And I was interviewing him. And I asked him about blood and gore and its uses and all of that. And he said he had just been at a screening of RoboCop in Chicago, speaking of RoboCop again. And he said there was a couple in front of him with their 8-year-old child with them. and this is, folks, this is Clive Barker. Okay.
Yeah.
And Clive said, I love gore, you know, bloody chunks and hands being blown off is great, but not for an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
And he said, that's not cool. And I just feel like we've lost track of that. You know, when my daughter was in the fourth grade, she's 17 now, when she was in the fourth grade, one of her classmates' parents would let this girl stay up and watch The Walking Dead with them.
That's in the fourth grade. Yeah.
You know, and I'm sorry that's not, I don't know. Anyway.
I think it's okay to try to maintain some innocence, you know?
Yeah. I just feel like there's got to be a line, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. Anyway.
Did you ever read the book, like one of my favorite horror books coming out of the 80s, and there's a series of them called The Necroscope by Brian Lumley?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And man, that book gets super violent and super gory. But I wouldn't let my, you know, and I wouldn't let my 10-year-old or my 6-year-old read it. You know what I mean? Or read from it to them.
Exactly.
But and I love again, that book. I love that series.
But you judge by the kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you can gauge by the kid. I mean, not a 6-year-old, but you know.
Right.
Of Saints and Shadows is filled with absolute over the top gore and sex and violence and, you know. I've done other stuff that's in the same vein. The books in that series tend to be.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But I'm not handing it to a kid. And if you made it into a movie, I wouldn't want it to be made for – I wouldn't want – you know, if it's going to be that gory, it's for the audience that it's made for.
Yeah. And Ten Men, you basically write one of your great fears out that politicians no longer care for lying. Or that we even know that they're lying. They don't care anymore. You think we're there?
Yeah. Well, look, I was interviewed probably 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And or whenever it was. And I keep coming back to this interview because it was that thing where like, oh, there's another horror guy. We're going to ask him the same question we asked every other horror person.
Right.
Which is, you know, what scares you?
Right. That's a canned question,
They don't expect you to give them a sober, real-world response.
Right.
And my response was, what scares me most is that politicians no longer feel like they have to pretend that they're not lying to you. And that was then. Now, there's like no facade whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, the lies are just like, I mean, it's insane. So you have like Trump right now saying, or a few weeks ago, saying we have 15 cases in a week or so, it'll be down to zero by April, by the beginning of April, it'll all be over. And right. Now you have him every single day, even though this is on video, right? I mean, you've got him on video saying that all over the country. Every news channel in the world carried him saying that.
Yeah.
But now ask him, he bald faced just says, I never said that. So
yeah, this is a bald faced lie. It's like,
now I would say what scares me the most is not the lies. What scares me the most is that the lies happen and nobody blinks.
Right.
So used to the lies, and it just keep getting compounded more and more lies, and it's the people just forget what the truth is.
Exactly. And the thing is, like, I know, well, I sort of know a couple of people who are in the White House press corps, but I actually personally know one of them. And I just wish, and I don't want this person to lose their job, but I wish somebody in the White House press corps would just say, you are a lying sack of shit. You're lying awesome. To everybody right now. Just call them lies. They're lies.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about Trump, by the way. I mean, this is like,
oh, it's across the board.
It's endemic to, yeah. Yeah. So it's not, and again, like I make no secret of my politics. Anybody who follows me on social media knows how I feel about everything, because I don't hide anything. People come, get messages all the time, sometimes from other professionals who say, aren't you worried? You're going to lose readers. You're going to blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm 52 years old.
Yep.
I've been doing this, for 28 years this year and so if people don't want to come and read me, then I'll find something else to do. It's fine.
Yeah.
I have friends who work as baristas at Starbucks. I'm not afraid to do the same. That's fine.
I like it.
I love it.
So I got a question for you, and you can tell me if the beginning is you don't want to talk about, and that's fine. But you've dealt with Alzheimer's in your personal life.
Yes.
And from a few different, relatives. And I'm
dealing with it now as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm curious, how has this affected your writing and how you look at life in general?
Well, I mean, so we have various theories about this in my family, but yeah. I lost my Uncle Rich and just recently lost my Uncle Brian. I have other relatives who currently are dealing with it. And weirdly, I think that those two uncles, Rich was a dentist and Brian was a doctor,
yeah.
and they shared an office in an old house in Medford, Massachusetts.
Oh, interesting.
And when they were doing this, it was at a time when dental fillings still had mercury in them.
Yeah.
And so it's been posited, at least, that it's possible that it was mercury exposure. But I don't know if that's a thing. You know what I mean? Because the people in my family who didn't spend time in that building don't seem to have
any issues.
Alzheimer's disease as a thing.
Wow, that's weird.
So it's a weird thing. But suffice to say, both my novel, The Boys Are Back in Town, and my novel, Wildwood Road, are both about erasure of identity and the loss of identity and loss of self. And definitely spring from the horror of learning what it means. I mean, and I don't want to say, I loved my uncles, but I didn't spend a lot of time with them. I didn't, I didn't see them that often growing up. I saw them enough to love them, but certainly not like my cousins who were their kids,
Right. You're closer to the cousins.
It wasn't my dad. My dad died when I was 19. He died of cancer. But so suffice to say that, it haunted me, because I would see my Uncle Rich and I saw his debilitation. I saw the way that he unraveled,
Yeah.
And I heard stories from my cousins and stuff like that. And it really got under my skin. I've seen it enough that I have flat out, and not in any, I want to be clear about this, not in any sort of dramatic way or trying to be melodramatic in any way. But I told my wife that if I ever develop Alzheimer's and there's nothing that they can do for me, the minute that I think I'm starting to really slide, I'm out of here. I'm done.
Yeah.
Because I'm not doing that to myself. I don't want to live that life, and I don't want to do it to my family. It is my number one horror.
I think for me too, when I think about it, just losing myself in some ways. Like I could deal my leg got amputated, or you know what I mean, or I'm incapacitated in some way physically. Okay, I still got my mind. I can still do things, you know, within myself. Then I'll make it through. I'll persevere. But that is something that really scares me.
When you get into an advanced state in Alzheimer's, you're frightened all of the time.
Yeah, that's even worse.
It just seems to be living in terror to me, and living it, and also, you know, the torment that you put your family through, the torment that your family goes through because of your disease, not that you're putting them through that.
Right.
Just clarify that. You know, so I definitely would find some way to check out. Check out, put me in the cremation tube and I'm done. That's good.
Right, right. Dude, I'd be right there.
And again, I don't say that to be dramatic. I'm just pragmatic about it.
You know? No, I feel the same way. I mean, if I'm slipping and I know from the day that that's it, man, give me that pill, you know?
Yep.
Where's Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, assisted suicide should be legal in all 50 states in this country. It's ridiculous to get political again.
I agree with that.
I'm not afraid of doing.
Yeah. No,
it's ridiculous.
Preach.
It is absolutely ridiculous that you can't choose that, that you can't, in full knowledge of what you're choosing, make the choice not to suffer. It is insane. And one of the problems with the puritanical.
That's a great way to put it too. Make the choice to not to suffer. You know, to not suffer. And it's like, how is that even? I mean, it should just be there. I mean, I think Washington State is a right state for that. And Oregon is as well. So you can, you know, we could take a trip down.
I will pay a visit.
Pay a visit. And I'm just going to stay here for the rest of my short life.
Yep. I will visit you guys. I'll get incinerated. And then you can ship me back FedEx.
There you go. There we go. We'll overnight you just to make it easier.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Prowlers is a series of books that you did, which has a nice twist. Instead of humans turning to werewolves, you have animals that are disguising as humans to better infiltrate. Yeah, where the fuck did you come up with this?
Totally inspired by Del Toro's Mimic. What I always try to do is when I did my one and only zombie novel, when I did even go back to my first novel of Saints and Shadows, when I did Prowlers, which are werewolf stories, I always try to find a different way in. And, you know, growing up reading Wolfen by Whitley Strieber and watching American Werewolf in London and watching The Howling, which I actually got my son Dan to watch recently, you know, there's great and some great unknown. Like there's a novel called Quarrel with the Moon by J.C. Conaway from the 80s. Great werewolf novel. So I have these, you know, I have those influences, but I would always think, you know, what's another way in?
Yeah.
You know? And so, yeah, Prowlers was this idea of, you know, what if these monstrous wolf-like animals develop the ability to appear human, to basically pass in the human world to help them survive. So instead of getting exterminated, you know, 1,500 years ago, they managed to live on into the present day by merging or blending in with society.
Mimicking.
Exactly.
That sounds like it'd be a great movie.
I agree.
I'm just saying. It just sounds like it'd be a great horror movie.
Yeah. Yeah. We almost had it set up at Fox years ago when it first came out. And unfortunately, the guy who was the executive at Fox at the time, you know, he just couldn't get it into his head.
Yeah.
You know? He never turned it down. He never gave us a yes or a no.
He just strung you along for a while.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
we had a guy do that on our podcast every day. Oh yeah, I'll be there. And then the next day, the next day, the next day.
Oh no.
6 days of it in a row, and I was like, oh man, you're killing me.
You should out him right now. You should definitely throw him under the bus right now.
Well, no, because now we emailed him, and then he came back and said, oh yeah, I'm down, let's do this. We're like, you motherfucker, man.
You know what? From now on, he should be your Matt Damon.
He is. He is.
At the end of every episode, you should say, you know, and apologies to this person, we ran out of time, just like Kimmel does to Matt Damon.
Yeah.
You should do it every show.
I got to ask you, working with Amber Benson, how was that experience? And, like, do you know if Ghosts of Albion is going to be available? Because it was on BBC for the Flash animation, but there's no browsers that support Flash too much anymore. And so you can't really go and go watch it.
I hadn't thought about that because last I checked, you could still watch it.
Yeah. And I want to watch it. I've never seen it.
Yeah. Oh, you've never seen it?
No, I just heard all this cool stuff about it. And I just watched last year for the first time in my life, sat and watched all of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Okay.
I didn't watch it when it came out. So I was like, okay, well, now that it was...
Well, you know, it's funny because, so, you know, look, I've gotten shit from certain people over the course of my career for doing media tie-ins and doing other things.
Whatever.
But, you know, I always look at it from the perspective of 15-year-old me, right? So my personal novels are more important to me in many ways than anything else that I do.
Yeah.
It's more personal. It's more intimate. It's more, you know, so I get into that. But at the same time, two other things come into play. One is this idea of, like, would 15-year-old me be pissed at me if I said no to this opportunity?
Right.
Right. And if the answer is yes, then I do everything I can to make that thing happen. And then the other part is that, you know, you have friends, right? You make friends with when you're a writer, you make friends with other writers.
Yeah.
And so as a fan of the team up, you know what I mean? Like I just always look at like this opportunity, like, you know, my buddy Jim Moore and I were on an elevator one time, and while on the elevator, I don't know how it came up, but it was just like, oh, you know, it would be cool. We're just in conversation. You know, it'd be cool if like the Twister comes through Kansas and all the Oz characters are vampires and they spill out of the Twister and they overrun Kansas and kill Dorothy and her whole family. And we laughed about it. And by the time the elevator ride was over, we looked at each other and we're like, you know, we have to write that.
Yeah.
And so that's the other way that stuff that isn't as sort of personal comes about. So with Amber, it was like, I was already writing these Buffy the Vampire Slayer novels and comics and stuff because I loved the show.
Yeah.
And a mutual friend of ours named Ali Costa, who had a website for Amber and did my website for many, many years. At the time, I was coming to LA for meetings and Ali was like, you know, you really need to meet Amber. So let's have lunch. So we all got together for lunch. Amber and I became friendly. The next time I went out there, we had a big group dinner. And actually Amber's mom was there. There were a ton of people there. And Amber's mother said to me, you know, Amber's a writer too. And I was like, what? And she's like, yeah, she's written a number of stage plays. Oh, and I said, cool. Oh, I'd love to read them. And then I said, you know, hey, you know, Amber, like I had already written a Spike and Drew comic with James Marsters. So I said, you know, if you ever want to write comics with Dark Horse, I'm sure that they'd love to have you do, maybe we could do Willow and Tara.
Yeah.
Then I went home and her mom sent me a couple of plays that she'd written. And I was like, wow, she's really talented. And then the more we got to talking and the better friends we got, the more I realized that actually writing was her thing. You know, I mean, she was an actress, but she wanted to direct and she wanted to write because she was way more on that wavelength. And so we became like really close friends. You know, still we're actually working on two TV pitch projects right now together.
Oh, good luck.
So we're always sort of working on various things together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really weird to go out in public with her and have somebody recognize her still, because I don't think of her as a person who was ever on television.
Right. She's just your friend.
Yeah. And it's just not like it's, you know, it's amusing in many ways, you know, like, I don't know. It's like, because if you, you know, I don't know, for instance, like, I don't know James Marsters that well,
yeah,
but we're friendly, you know, right. Like anytime I see him or like when he's in Boston for a convention, I'll see him, you know, great guy. But you are never with James and don't realize he's an actor.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean? That's not a negative. Not, you know, I'm just saying like he's always thinking about the fact that he's an actor and he has to be aware of that, you know, and Amber's never given a fuck.
Right. Right.
Like just never. So yeah.
I mean, she's got no fucks to give.
She has zero. When we were first getting to be friends, her sister Danielle had her head shaved down to just like fuzz.
Yeah.
And Amber and Danielle, if Amber was going to like an event in LA, she'd often bring Danielle with her. And Amber, you know, would wear whatever she felt like wearing, you know, like overalls, whatever.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people thought Danny was her girlfriend because they thought she was gay because she played a lesbian on TV. And then Danny had her hair shaved down to almost nothing. And what I
hope she played that up.
Was she just didn't care. Like she didn't care at all.
Yeah.
About what anybody might make of that. And that's, I think, why we became friends, because I really admired the zero fucks that she gave.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. Are you guys, so you guys are working on these TV pitches, and good luck with that, by the way. I hope something comes about. But are you guys done doing any novels together? Or, because you've done quite a few, but I couldn't find anything.
The thing is that Amber had reached the point where she just decided she was done for a while, at least with novels. We had done the Ghost of Albion stuff, and then she had moved on to do her own stuff. And then she kind of, I don't know, you'd have to interview her about that. But she had decided at a certain point she wasn't really that interested in it for a while. She still writes short stories occasionally, but most of what she's writing is TV movies. She's written a ton of them.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, she's writing a ton of TV movies and getting paid a hell of a lot more money than she got paid for the novels that she was writing. So, but back to your Ghost of Albion question. I'll have to look it up. I have it still, so, you know, the BBC would sue me if I put it up on YouTube.
You're right.
But, you know, but it may still be available somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to find it because I want to watch it. I didn't even know about it until I started doing research. I knew you through Mike Mignola, which I'm sure you have a lot of fans that come through him.
Yeah.
And then I started doing research. I'm like, what is this? And then Amber Benson, or, you know, I really didn't know who Amber Benson was as a person until I looked her up. And I'm like, oh, she was Tara on Buffy, and she wrote all this stuff. That is awesome. And then, you know, and then I started seeing all these reviews on Ghost of Albion, and it was, you know, for lack of a better term, a big success, has a cult following. So I was, and then there's all these games around it, like RPG games.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is crazy. I want to watch the original stuff. And then I finally found it on BBC. I think it's bbc.uk.com or just whatever the BBC website is. And it comes up and it goes, your browser must support Flash. And I'm like, fuck. And I'm sure I can figure it out. You know, I can download a Flash enabled browser.
I will say that the second one is not nearly as good for several reasons.
Yeah.
One of which is that the animation was done by somebody else.
Yeah.
And you know, the first hour of the original Ghost of Albion, we did two of them. The original one, it's Flash animation, dude. It's crude. I mean, it's so rudimentary, but I still love it so much. And the performances are great. I mean, I don't know if you saw these days, the actor in it who's maybe best known is Rory Kinnear, who is, did you watch, God, I can't think of it, Penny Dreadful?
Oh, yeah.
He's the Frankenstein monster.
Oh, cool.
And my friend Jasmine Hyde, who she and Rory are brother and sister in Ghost of Albion. Jasmine just made this movie that was called The Unseen in the UK. In the US, it's called something like Amaurosis, and Jasmine's the star of that. She's terrific.
Oh, nice.
I'd have to go through the whole thing. But yeah, but so like Emma Sams, who was on Dynasty when I was a kid, you know, like.
Yeah. He's had all these amazing people.
C-3PO. Anthony Daniels is in it.
That's so cool.
And Amber directed the first one.
Yeah.
And so we were there on set for the whole thing together, and it was such a great experience. God, that's one of my favorite like professional experiences is working on that.
Did it kind of give you, for lack of a better term, the TV bug?
Weirdly, I had when I was in high school, I was planning to go to film school. And then I decided that I wanted to get the best education that I possibly could just in case that didn't work out. So I went to the best school I could get into. And while I was there, while I was at college,
yeah,
I had started writing in high school. But while I was at college, I started writing much, much more. And my senior year, I started writing my first novel. And at that point, I was like, you know what? I think I'm good. I think this is what I want to do.
Yeah, this is what I got a passion for.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have always tried to write something.
I'm a control freak, so.
Yeah.
Writing a novel means I can do whatever I want.
You're God in all its wisdom.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I've tried to write novels. I've had like, I probably have like 10, 15 started, never finished. I always get to like a couple chapters in and then I don't know if I lose interest. I think I lose drive. Maybe that's the same fucking thing. I don't know.
You know what? Honestly, that's the way I was a million years ago when I was, and it changed when I was a senior in college.
Yeah.
I was writing, I'd only written short stories. I'd thought about writing a novel. And then I thought, oh, you know what? If I treat every chapter like it's its own short story with its own beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
Before I know it, I'll have finished a novel. And that's what happened. So get back to it.
Yeah. Well,
do it
someday.
I have half a novel written. I've written half of one. And that's it sits on my computer waiting for me to finish it. So,
well, then you guys can just put those together and, you know.
Yeah, we have. There you go, man. We can just Frankenstein them together and it'll be good. Yeah. It'll make no fucking sense.
You could take the first two chapters of 10 different novels, put it all together, just called it Stuff I Couldn't Be Bothered to Finish.
Right. Yeah. Somebody will be reading it and they'll get to the stop where you stop and they'll be like, what the fuck happens? And then we'll start getting threatening letters and
you must finish this story.
Exactly. No, it's like, it should be like a choose your own adventure, you know, except you have to write the rest. Publish
it at the first. Write your own endings.
It's just two chapters and the rest of the book is lined paper. So whoever buys
it's an activity book.
Send it back to you.
It is an activity book. We're concentrating on our podcast now. We're having a lot of fun. We do have a comic book that we're working on, and Johnny just released an anthology called The Ainz Anthology. And he set the first, he's got how many books in the series? Six?
Four books.
Four
books.
Yeah. And the first one got sent to the printer and then COVID-19 hit. So we're waiting. This is
an interesting time. By the way, I'm just busting your balls. You guys, it is something that requires you to sit down and do it. And you love it some days, but a lot of times it's drudgery.
Yeah.
And I talk to people so often. If you get my buddy Jim Moore on here someday, he's the guy you need to talk to because he will actually like start haunting you. He'll stand outside the window and glare at you until you sit down and write. He'll threaten to break your arms.
Right.
You think I'm kidding. He won't actually stand outside your window, but he will threaten physical harm.
Nice.
You'd be astounded at how many people I know who finished their first novel only under threat.
That's hilarious.
Nice.
From Jim.
Hey, whatever works. Whatever works.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Whatever works. Exactly. We have a new comic book that we're working on, though. We're really excited for it. We actually had a whole brainstorming session on a podcast. And we do this series called TOTS. And it stands for a tangent of tangents, where we get on and we just start talking. And before you know it, we've gone through 30 different fucking topics. You know what I mean? And and it's funny because we do a ton of interviews. Like we release like 4 or 5 episodes a week and they're all, and they're all interviews. And we've interviewed so many people. It's kind of crazy. And, but we get a lot of people saying, you guys need to do more of those tots because whatever reason, people love them. But we had this one where we started talking and we brainstormed this whole story. And so now we're actually going to write it in brainstorming fashion using the podcast to drive it.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah. So we're excited. So we got the first one done. Now we got to set up the second one where we have like the general idea. And now it's time to really start mapping it out. Right. It should be a lot of fun. So,
Hey, listen, I would be I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my podcast.
Please do. I was just going to ask, what can we promote for you?
Well, so legendary horror writer Brian Keene and I do a podcast every week. We just recorded episode 97 today.
Nice.
Called Defenders Dialogue. Defenders Dialogue started with me texting Brian. Brian and I are exactly the same age. And I texted him and I said, you know, we should do a reread from issue one of the Defenders, the, you know, 70s and 80s version of the Defenders from Marvel.
Yeah.
And talk about it every week and just record it as a podcast. And I said to him at the time, no one will listen to it. It will be the ultimate fanboy wank of all time. but it would be really fun for us. And it's an hour every week that we don't have to think about the world ending, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was like, yes, we're doing it tomorrow. And
you're making me laugh.
So now we're on episode 97. We've gone through all of the Defenders, the Champions, Black Goliath, the Marvel Godzilla from the 70s.
Oh, that's awesome.
We're currently doing Supervillain Team Up. We're going to do Man-Thing. I think we're going to do Marvel 2-in-1. And so it's just all Bronze Age Marvel comics. Damn. And it's a blast.
That's my jam. Yeah. I'm 45.
Awesome. Defenders Dialogue. And again, like, it's – every time Brian, I don't know how many people listen to it, not many, but way more than I ever anticipated. Every time Brian tells me, oh, this person listens to the show, I'm like, why?
Why?
I don't understand. So if you're out there listening to this and you think this sounds entertaining, I don't understand why you would find it entertaining, but if you do, go listen to Defenders Dialogue.
You guys have guests on?
The only time we've had a couple guests on only when they tie into what we're covering.
Yeah.
So like we've had Scott Edelman on a couple of times, and we had J.M. DeMatteis on
because
they both worked on the Defenders.
Yeah, we had him on a month ago. He was awesome.
Yeah, he's great. And we've had my buddy Tom Snegoski has come on and sat in for Brian a couple of times, mainly because Tom hated the Defenders.
Yeah.
So when Brian wasn't able to do it, I had Tom come in and join me to, you know, so we could talk about, you know, what he hated about it, you know.
Just railed against him. Yeah. Do you have any new books coming out soon that people need to be aware of?
Yeah, well, always. I did a book a few years ago called Ararat that won the Bram Stoker Award. And the second book, The Pandora Room, just came out in paperback a couple months ago. The third book, and again, they're totally standalone. You can read them individually. You don't have to read them in order.
Yeah.
But the third book is called Red Hands, and that comes out in December.
Oh, cool.
And I'm actually writing the pilot and the Bible for a TV series based on that character, the main character of those books right now with
cool.
AGC Television, the people behind the War of the Worlds show that's on right now.
Yep.
And then the second omnibus of Baltimore, which I created with Mignola.
Yeah.
Just came out, just hit comic shops. Well, comic shops, most of them are closed.
Right.
But if you can get it from your local comic shop, get it from your local comic shop. But it is available, Baltimore Omnibus Volume 2. And as soon as the coronavirus is over, we have a new comic book miniseries starting called Lady Baltimore, which will be out from Dark Horse whenever this shit passes us by.
Yeah.
And with art by Bridget Connell, who is brilliant. She's doing such a fantastic job.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, Chris,
yeah,
we've been over an hour. Can you believe it?
No.
Yeah. It's what we do, man.
We're just getting wound up.
You make it so funny. Don't know.
I know. Dude, you have so much stuff out there. I want to get you to come back on. Can we do that? Can we get you to come back?
Sure.
Because as
you can tell, I have no problem talking.
Yeah, no, I love that because I don't have a problem talking. Matter of fact, if you and I just sat at a bar, we'd probably over-talk each other the whole time and then thinking that we both were like, oh, that was great, I'll talk to you later, and then get in our cars and probably realize, I don't know what the fuck he said because we were both just talking.
All right, well, I'm going to go over time another minute. And
Right?
So, you know the comedian Billy Connolly?
Oh, yeah.
So when I was growing up, I was a kid who listened to a lot of comedy albums, and I'd be able to, like, you know,
yeah, me too.
Probably regurgitate half of what was on each one of those albums.
Yeah.
and I, like, I would go see a couple times I would see a comedian, and I would remember so much of the show and be able to sort of spit it back to you afterwards. But many years ago, in, like, I want to say 1991 or so, Billy Connolly did an HBO special called Pale Blue Scottish Person.
Yeah.
And I laughed my ass off the entire time. And at the end of the special, he says, you know, you're all going to go home. And you're going to say, your friends are going to say, what'd you do tonight? I went to see this comedian, Billy Connolly. Was he funny? He was fucking hilarious. What did he talk about? And you're going to say, I have no fucking idea. And I swear to God, I never laughed so hard as I laughed at that joke, because he was 100% correct. I remembered one sheep fucking joke and nothing else from the entire hour and a half or whatever the thing was.
Oh, man.
But there you go.
You're a stand-up comedian fan, obviously, if you're listening to Billy Connolly. Are you excited for Eddie Murphy to get back out and tour?
You know, I loved Dolomite Is My Name.
Oh, my God. It was so good.
But I am dubious about whether Eddie still has the comedy in him.
Since the 80s, man, that he's done it. But Delirious, I wore that tape out.
I know, man.
I listened to it so much.
I could still give you back parts of Delirious.
Oh, yeah. I still quote it. Goonie Goo. What the fuck does that mean? All right. I still say stuff from fucking Delirious and even Raw, you know? And it's just, I'm so excited. I'll pay $1,000 to go see him.
It's like if you see him, he seems like he's, and I don't know him, obviously.
Yeah.
And so who knows? He doesn't look like necessarily a guy who is sparking with that kind of energy.
Yeah. Well, I think,
and so I'm super curious to see if he can be really funny.
Yeah. I'm excited because he's my all time favorite comedian. Like I can't help. I still quote his stuff, and I saw him on Comedian Cars Getting Coffee with Seinfeld on Netflix. And I think that's what's got this ball rolling, was that episode. And
I'll have to watch that.
Yeah.
Cause for me, it's Eddie Murphy, it's George Carlin, it's Richard Pryor, Steve Martin.
Yep.
Stephen
Oh my God.
Wright,
oh.
Dude, Bill Hicks.
Yes.
Steve Martin, you know, talking about, does anybody have little cat cuffs? My cat, I need to put cat cuffs on my cat to the catamaran to go to Catalina. Oh my God. I lost it.
Yeah. Anyway.
Chris.
All right.
Thank you so much for coming on. Let's plan it again. You know, I would love to go through and talk about Baltimore. We actually just promoted your book off our website, spoilerverse.com. And
thank you.
Last month for it coming out for the Omnibus. John just sent me the article that we had written for it. He was like, wait, we had a press, because we're on the press release for Dark Horse and Marvel and all them. So we pushed it out. So I'd love to have you come back on if you're interested. And maybe go through the book and talk about why you made. We do this thing called commentary tracks, and our thought process is, let's do a DVD commentary, but for comic books. And we had Frank Gogol on. He did Dead End Kids. We did Stephen Frank. I don't know if you know who he is. He did Silver. And we had Kevin Joseph on, who did Tart. And I think that's it so far.
That's all it's released. We have some more lined up to record.
Yeah. Yeah. Straczynski's coming on to do his new one.
The Resistance.
Resistance. Yeah.
So cool. That's, yeah. No, I'd love to do that. I mean, I'm sure I'll sound like a dumbass, but I'm happy to do it.
Dude, you're going to sound like a dumbass. Wait till I ask the questions. So we really appreciate you coming on, and we'll talk soon. Pleasure.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was so much fun.
It's fun because he wrote Lady Baltimore, which we ended up writing a review, not a review, but a press release for it, like a month before he came on. And then we talked to him. It was like we didn't know that when we talked to him that he had written that. It just all kind of like circled around.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is cool.
It was all organic.
Yeah, yeah. He was fun. I hope we get him to come back on to talk about more stuff. We actually talked about having him come on to do another episode at the end of the show. It's not in the episodes. You don't hear him to us talk about it, but
right.
We have actually had our public relations manager, Jeff Haas, reach out to him again to have him come back on to talk about that hidden subject I'm not telling you about. You'll have to wait till it comes out, but it's going to be a lot of fun.
There you go. Man. Well, Johnny.
Yeah?
That was a lot of fun. Thanks for joining me on talking with Christopher Golden.
Yeah, thanks for allowing me to talk on that one.
Allowing you to talk. Don't forget it. I will put you back in that closet.
I'll be good. I'll be good. I'm sorry. Don't hit me again.
I told you to wash the car, not take it down to the grocery store. All right, guys. We're out of here. That is the show. Thanks to Christopher Golden for coming on. Hey, if you like what you heard and you want to hear more, go check out spoilerverse.com. There's a ton of stuff there for you to check out. Lots of articles and a whole bunch of other podcasts that have equally great content.
Yeah, and we have articles, reviews, and previews, and press releases, and blog posts from a plethora of people up there for you to check out. And we have a store. Click store in the middle there. Go buy a t-shirt, buy a hoodie, buy a mug, whatever, and support the show.
Yep. You guys go. All right, we're out. So don't forget.
In an oceans of podcasts, we are Cthulhu.
And as Cthulhu compels you to do,
open the mind.